It is Friday, March the 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. Coming up, new Russian nuclear claims.
There's a lot of reasons why Vladimir Putin would talk about these capabilities, would brag about these capabilities. Again, the question remains, when push comes to shove, how much of these capabilities do the Russians have, and how much, if at all, does it change the game?
U.S. to impose new duties on steel and aluminum.
We're going to bring it back relatively rapidly, and we're going to be instituting tariffs.
Also, humanitarian aid in Syria, plus some really popular children's songs. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The United States is brushing aside a series of claims by Russian President Vladimir Putin that he has an array of new strategic nuclear weapons that can hit a target anywhere in the world. Both the White House and the Pentagon here in Washington dismissed the talks as rhetoric. My colleague Sarah Williams speaks with VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Seldon about all of this.
Well, officials at the Pentagon and in the U.S. national security community are taking a look at the specific weapons that he mentioned, but one of the things officials have said and have known about for quite some time is that Russia, under Putin, has put an emphasis on modernizing and updating its military capabilities, both its conventional military capabilities and its nuclear military capabilities. So the fact that Russia is working on upgraded defenses, missile capabilities, really isn't a shock to anybody in the U.S. Now, whether or not these systems that he mentioned, the cruise missile he talked about that he said can invade all U.S. defenses, whether or not those can actually live up to the hype or are actually ready to go and can be deployed now, those are much bigger questions, and there is some skepticism about how far along the Russians actually are.
Yes, because he said that these new strategic nuclear weapons can hit almost any target in the world and cannot be intercepted by foreign adversaries. That's a pretty broad claim.
It is a broad claim, but it fits into a narrative that Russia under Putin has been trying to craft and build upon for some time, and that is that Russia is a military power that is equal or superior in some cases to the United States or any other power in the West. Now, U.S. officials will tell you that's simply not true. The U.S. has more military capability than Russia. But it's something that Russia wants to believe. It wants the world to believe. And it's a message that's been building for a couple of reasons. First of all, you do have elections coming up in Russia, and while there's little doubt that Putin is going to win, this is the type of red meat, if you will, that politicians will toss out to their base to get people to feel more enthusiastic about them and about their cause and about their chances under their leadership. So there's a little bit of an internal political game that could be going on here. But also, Russia has really been intent on reestablishing itself and trying to craft a position for itself as a dominant power, as an equal or more than an equal with the U.S. on the world stage. And one of the ways it's tried to do that is with its military and the way it's used its military in places like Ukraine, in places like Syria, which U.S. officials have said some of what Russia has been doing has been tactical or strategic in terms of achieving aims in Ukraine or propping up the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But they've also said that Russia has been using those areas as basically a showroom. They've been using those conflicts as a showroom to show off their weaponry, to generate weapon sales. To the extent that's worked is a question, but countries that have previously done business with the U.S. and bought U.S. weaponry, like Egypt, Turkey, they have been talking with Russia. There's been some renewed interest in Russian military capabilities for other countries that want to buy equipment and hardware. So there's a lot of reasons why Vladimir Putin would talk about these capabilities, would brag about these capabilities in a speech. Again, the question remains, when push comes to shove, how much of these capabilities do the Russians have, and how much, if at all, does it change the game? Remember, one of the things that Russia's been most successful at and most adept at, according to intelligence officials in the U.S. and across the West, has not just been what he's been able to do with his military power, but the hybrid techniques that he uses, the combination of traditional military means and cyber operations, misinformation, disinformation campaigns. And that's part of what's made Russia such a formidable enemy for the West on the world stage.
That is VOA national security correspondent Jeff Seldon speaking with VOA's Sarah Williams. Also in the news, President Trump has announced a new tariff on imported steel and aluminum products, a move he said would boost the U.S. economy and help national security. During a White House briefing with top executives from U.S. steel and aluminum companies, President Trump said the tariffs of 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum imports will be in effect for a long period of time. He said the measure will be signed sometime next week.
So we're bringing it back, and we're going to bring it back relatively rapidly, and we're going to be instituting tariffs. Next week we'll be signing. Perhaps some of you folks will be here. When you have Nucor, when you have U.S. Steel, you have the great aluminum companies represented at this table, and they've been decimated. Aluminum has been decimated in the country.
Mr. Trump also said U.S. steel and aluminum industries have been decimated, as we heard, and he vowed that other nations would no longer have an unfair advantage. The president said a series of what he called disasters had hurt the U.S. economy while boosting the economies of other nations, including China.
The NAFTA deal was a disaster for our country. The WTO has been a disaster for this country, for our country. In fact, the rise of China economically was, if you look at it, directly equal to the date of the opening of the World Trade Organization. It has been great for China and terrible for the United States, and great for other countries, but terrible for the United States.
Critics of the plan fear other countries will retaliate or use national security as a pretext to impose trade penalties of their own. They also argue that sanctions on imports will drive up prices and hurt U.S. automakers and other companies which use steel or aluminum. The president's announcement sent shocks throughout the world, Wall Street, that is, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropping 1.7%, closing the day at just over 24,597. Automakers led the downturn, with Ford and General Motors prices slipping, and the S&P 500 fell 1.4% to 2677. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani used an international conference called the Kabul Process to outline a peace proposal without preconditions to the Taliban insurgency, saying it's prepared to recognize it as a political group, a move that could lead to talks to end their 16-year conflict. He proposed a ceasefire and a release of prisoners, along with new elections and a constitutional review. The comments come after a January suicide attack in the Afghan capital, in which the Taliban used an ambulance bomb that killed 95 people, wounded dozens more. And as of October, U.S. forces in Afghanistan said the Taliban controlled 14% of the country's districts, while the government controlled 56%, with 30% contested. Michael Kugelman, a South Asia senior associate at the Washington-based Wilson Center, tells my colleague Victor Beatty Mr. Ghani's proposal is extraordinary.
Extending an offer of peace to the Taliban is nothing new. I mean, the Afghan government has tried that in the past. But in this case, as you note, President Ghani has made so many extraordinarily generous concessions, or he's offered so many concessions, I think in many ways unprecedented. And he has also made this offer so very public. He essentially used this conference to essentially advertise the fact that he's ready to talk peace with the Taliban. I'm actually quite surprised, to be very honest. I really thought that after the Taliban claimed responsibility for that horrific attack in Kabul just a few weeks ago, where it admitted to putting explosives in an ambulance and blowing the ambulance up in the middle of Kabul. I thought after such a horrific attack like that, there was no way this Afghan government was going to be ready to extend the olive branch to the Taliban. So it's really a surprise on many levels.
Is there pressure on the Taliban to negotiate as well? Perhaps that's why it's a good time?
Well, I think that's just it. I mean, you know, to the question of why now? Why does Ghani decide to make this offer now? I think that he is essentially betting on the assumption that the Taliban is feeling more pressured on the battlefield, that the stepped-up U.S. military campaign against the Taliban is starting to pay off and make the Taliban feel uncomfortable and make it willing to step off the battlefield and negotiate peace. My own view is that it's a bit premature and a bit early to think that's the case. I actually think the Taliban, despite any added pressure it's feeling on the battlefield, is still in a very good position, controlling a lot of territory and waging a number of very effective offensives on the battlefield against Afghan forces.
The Taliban has indicated a willingness to talk to the United States, but not Afghanistan. Why?
Well, see, this is the crux of the matter here. I think that the Afghan government has extended an offer to talk to the Taliban, but the Taliban won't be interested. One reason being that it wants to talk to the Americans, not the Afghan government. Why? Well, you know, the Taliban's view is that the U.S. is an occupying force and that the Taliban is fighting the U.S. occupation. If U.S. Forces were to stop fighting, then the Taliban would be willing to step off the battlefield and negotiate with what it describes as its main enemy. Now, I think that's a bit of propaganda. I think in all reality, if U.S. forces were to stop fighting, if U.S. forces were to leave the country, the Taliban would not lay down its arms. On the contrary, it would simply ramp up its fight because it would be in an even better position at that point to intensify the fight against the Afghan state, which at the end of the day is its major target. The Taliban wants to overthrow the Afghan government and replace it with an Islamic state run by the Taliban.
That is Michael Kugelman, a senior Asia associate at the Washington-based Wilson Center. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. A senior UN official says he has received indications Syrian authorities may grant permission for United Nations humanitarian convoys to enter that besieged enclave of eastern Ghouta to deliver desperately needed aid to civilians there. Lisa Schlein reporting now from the UN in Geneva.
Except for a small delivery of aid for 7,000 people in mid-February, the nearly 400,000 residents of eastern Ghouta, a suburb of the Syrian capital Damascus, has been without humanitarian assistance for many months. Special advisor to the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Jan Egeland, blames that on the government of Bashar al-Assad, which has not given the United Nations the facilitation letter it needs to carry out its mission. He says convoys are ready to move into eastern Ghouta as soon as the UN gets the go-ahead. But he says he is hopeful that this impasse may change. He says an international task force on Syria was informed Tuesday the United Nations may receive a permit to enter the besieged town of Douma in eastern Ghouta in the next 2 days.
We have 43 trucks standing by to go there and full warehouses to load into the trucks as soon as we get the permit. It was also reported that our colleagues in the ICRC is able to reach another place in eastern Ghouta today. So maybe this was the bleakest hour. Maybe it is now changing.
Egeland says he will ask Russia, the United States, and other countries of influence to push for several UN aid deliveries into eastern Ghouta every week. He says it also is urgent to get Syrian permission for the medical evacuation of about 1,000 wounded and seriously ill people. He says he is not in favor of Russia's unilateral 5-hour daily pause in the fighting, as it is not possible to deliver humanitarian aid within that time frame. Egeland says it is crucial to negotiate a pause in the fighting that is respected by all warring parties, and to establish a two-way corridor that meets humanitarian standards, so supplies can go into eastern Ghouta and people can go out if they wish. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And still ahead on International Edition, the sounds of Tom Chapin.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world.
Hey, it's time now to find out what's trending on social media with VOA's Doug Bernard. Doug, what you got?
Well, here we are at the beginning of the month of March. Now, February in the United States famously is African-American History Month. It's a time when people reflect on the contributions and accomplishments of African-Americans. Well, March actually is Women's History Month in the United States. And interestingly, the hashtag Women's History Month is a huge trender today. And in a perhaps a bit of a change of pace, I've been looking through a lot of comments here. And, you know, as opposed to some of the segments we've done recently on more divisive topics such as the Parkland shooting, on gun control, on the Mueller investigation into possible Russian collusion, this topic and hashtag really seems to be remarkably snark-free. People are genuinely tweeting or posting on social media, Facebook, that kind of thing, genuinely nice comments about women that they either know or, you know, sort of know about, who have been inspirational for them. In fact, among those women tweeting out are Michelle Obama, the former First Lady. She has this to say, quote, "I'm an example of what is possible when girls from the very beginning of their lives are loved and nurtured by people around them. I was surrounded by extraordinary women in my life who taught me about quiet strength and dignity." That's just one example. There's lots of examples of that. You can find a lot of them under the hashtag Women's History Month. And as I say, you know, happily so, it's remarkably snark-free for social media. So people taking a moment, I think, at the beginning of this March and thinking about women who have played an important role in their lives.
Many thanks, Doug. That is VOA's Doug Bernard. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Inside a workshop in Nairobi, hundreds of women make handcrafted beads and pottery. Women at the Kazuri factory typically receive on-the-job training and get paid three times more than the national average. Elizabeth Matindachero is one of the original employees who began in 1975 and has been working ever since. She says there were two of us when we started, but now there are 350 of us. The jobs help me provide for the children's upkeep, pay school fees, feed them, and pay rent as well. Matthew Griffiths is a British tourist who loves the fact the product is made locally.
It's specific to Kenya, and it's great craftsmanship and a lot of skill involved. Very beautiful.
Millions of beads are produced each year at Kazuri. They sell their products online, and the company is continuing to expand operations. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It is time now for a little something from the world of music.
I was coming home in a yellow bus, but the bus broke down and stranded us. Coming home in a yellow bus, but the bus broke down and stranded us. It was a long, 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 long way home. So I hopped a train coming down the line. The caboose came loose, I got left behind. Hopped a train coming down the line. The caboose came loose, I got left behind. It was a long, 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 long way home.
Tom Chapin is an American singer, songwriter, and well-known activist. He's the brother of the late Harry Chapin, who was a chart topper with many of his songs, including Cats in the Cradle and Sunday Morning Sunrise. Tom's also been very successful, especially with his songs for children like Long Way Home.
By a submarine, but they left me off in the Philippines. Got picked up by a submarine, but they left me off in the Philippines. It was a long, 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 long way home. Then I took a jet, but I couldn't pay. So they threw me out of the cargo bay. Took a jet, but I couldn't pay. So they threw me out of the cargo bay. It was a long, 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 long way home. Oh, my parachute kept me safe from harm. But I landed in a tree on the neighbor's farm. Parachute kept me safe from harm. But I landed in a tree on the neighbor's farm. It was a long, long, long.
Tom Chapin was born in 1945 in New York City, graduating from Brooklyn Technical High School, and then attending State University of New York at Plattsburgh, where he graduated in 1966. Lots of causes are important to Tom Chapin. He supports the importance of arts and music education, advocates for an end to world hunger, and cares about the health and safety of our planet, as evidenced here in his song, This Pretty Planet.
This pretty planet, spinning through space, you're a garden, you're a harbor, you're a holy place. Golden sun going down, gentle blue giant, spin us around all through the night. Safe till the morning light.
This pretty planet spinning through space, you're a garden, you're a harbor, you're a holy place. Golden sun going down, gentle blue giant, spin us around.
This pretty planet spinning through space, you're a garden.
In the 1970s, Tom Chapin hosted a Sunday morning TV series for children here in the U.S. called Make-A-Wish. He has appeared in a number of Broadway productions and is married to Bonnie Brecker, former wife of film director Wes Craven. Chapin's daughters and stepdaughter are musicians, and he is the fifth cousin of country music singer Mary Chapin Carpenter. Always on Tom Chapin's playlist at concerts for children is Family Tree, likely one of his fans' favorites.
Before the days of Jell-O, lived a prehistoric fellow who loved a maid and courted her beneath the banyan tree. And they had lots of children, and their children all had children. And they kept on having children until one of them had me. We're a family. Our roots go deep down in history. From my great-great-granddaddy reaching up to me, we're a green and growing family tree. My grandpa came from Russia. My grandma came from Prussia. They met in Nova Scotia, had my dad in Tennessee. Then they moved to Yokohama, where daddy met my mama. Her dad
dad's from Alabama and her mom's part Cherokee.
A lot of fun, isn't he? It's Tom Chapin. A few years ago, he was here in Washington. I took my children to see it, along with some other people. Oh, we had a great time. Tom Chapin, wonderful guy. Hey, listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead, and we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and for our engineer, Jonah Cummings, I'm Steve Norman. We're all here in Washington wishing you a super Friday. Now a bit more from Tom Chapin.
And our kid will be bilingual, and though she may stay single, she could, of course, co-mingle with the king of Kathmandu. 'Cause we're a family, and we're a tree. Our roots go deep down in history. From my great-great-granddaddy reaching up to me, we're a green and growing family tree. Folks in Madagascar aren't the same as in Alaska. They got different foods, different moods, and different colored skin. You may have a different name, but underneath we're much the same. You're probably my cousin, and the whole world is our kin. We're a family, and we're a tree. Our roots go deep down in history. From my great-great-grandmother reaching up to me, we're a green and growing family tree. We're a green and growing family.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nigeria's democratic political process got a boost recently with help provided by the United States. U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria Stuart Symington joined more than 40 prominent Nigerian politicians and International Republican Institute, or IRI, President Daniel Twining to launch a new activity supported by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, to help political parties adopt better governance practices and improve the quality of political discourse. Implemented for USAID by IRI and Search for Common Ground, the three-year, $5.5 million responsive political party program will help the major national political parties in Nigeria improve responsiveness to their constituents. It will also contribute to creating peaceful participation ahead of the upcoming elections. The activity promises to help parties contesting the upcoming elections to become more representative of the citizenry and improve the oversight of government programs. It also aims to increase the frequency and intensity of political party interactions with their constituents, improve communication among party officials, candidates, and office holders at all levels, and boost the participation of marginalized groups in political processes and within the parties themselves. The Responsive Political Party Program will also help spread the message of peace and nonviolence through the electoral process, determine early warning signs of electoral violence, and formulate strategies to mitigate potential violence through conflict assessment in conjunction with political parties and civil society organizations. Working with IRI on this project, our parties will be stronger and more efficient, vibrant and responsive to the yearnings of Nigerians, Deputy Senate President Ike Ekemeremadu remarked. I assure you of the cooperation of the National Assembly towards the actualization of this noble initiative. If you seek to be followed, tell the story not only of what is wrong, but what you would do right for the future, Ambassador Symington told the assembled politicians. And the greatest right you can do is to inspire your members to come together and make Nigeria better.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From Washington.